where the sun don't ever shine, than to be home alone, knowing that you're gone, would cause me to lose my mind. So blow your whistle, freight train, take me far on down the track.
Isn't that just so laid back and groovy and beautiful? And Jerry just bouncing along in the background, comes forward, one really mellow solo, and then drops back into the background again. So that's kind of from the country music genre of the Grateful Dead, of which they are the masters, I think. My favorite country music is always by Jerry and the boys. Roseanne Cash, it comes in... almost tied for first place. We're going to do a Roseanne Cash show soon. Roseanne, by the way, rather courageously last week in the wake of this apparent shooting scenario in Las Vegas, came out with a call to the country music industry to get off the wagon of the NRA, to get off this whole jingoistic guns, God, and whatever glory type of thing, and like realize this is hurting people, and that this organization is not anyone's friend, no one's friend. They're not even their own friend. They're a complete scam, and I will be doing their chart soon. I am well familiar with the chart of the NRA. That is more appropriate for Scorpio time, and that's coming right up. So if I recall, the NRA is a Scorpio, and it's just a really interesting chart. And the NRA, I think, had legitimate roots. You know, it starts as a thing to teach gun safety. Now, if you believe that, you know, guns shouldn't exist, which is an easy case to make, but you admit that they do exist, presumably you want to have people trained in how to run a firing range and how to clean these things and handle them safely and all that, which of course just facilitates more and more killing, but at least fewer accidents and more better intentional killing and fewer accidental deaths. And it's grown into this lobby organization that has way too much influence, A, for its size, it's not that big, and B, for the fact that most of its members, 75% of its members, from what I keep reading over and over again, want tighter gun control restrictions. You're listening to Planet Waves FM, part of the Pacifica Radio Network. We are a little different organization than Planet Waves. It's called Chiron Return Incorporated, a nonprofit corporation with its own board of directors and its own teaching agenda. It's been a little bit busy to do the investigative reporting from the kitchen table class in the fall. I don't really foresee that happening with the annual edition coming up, by the way, called The Art of Becoming, about all these all of these transits. We'll do that class. And that class is a thing of Chiron Return Incorporated, as is our other major project, the Gemstone File, the hosting of 250,000 corporate documents on the internet. So the one last bit of contemporary or forthcoming astrology anyway, the Harbinger of the Future, part two of about five parts will comprise the Art of Becoming. But part two of that is Saturn's ingress into Capricorn. Let's just take a look at that chart right now. And part of why this is so interesting is because the Saturn Capricorn angle is governmental. It's about the government and corporate structure, family structure, parental structure, all the same thing. The family is the authoritarian miniature state. And this chart for Saturn entering Capricorn is really interesting. I thought I knew this chart. I'm seeing things that I didn't dream of. So, first of all, the sky is concentrated in, everything's sort of on one half of the sky. Scorpio got three major points. Sag, four, a cluster in Capricorn, a couple in Aquarius, then a whole streak of things in Pisces, and then the Uranus-Eris conjunction in Aries. Five signs. Is that right? Five signs. Concentration. And the sun, well, this happens on the 20th, so it happens right before the northern hemisphere winter solstice, a.k.a. the southern solstice. So the sun's at 28.5 degrees of Sag, and it's exactly conjunct Tholus. A lot is going to move. Tholus, if you recall from last week's discussion, is the pressurized release. It all comes out at once. That's where the sun is conjunct. And then Saturn, of course, is in the very first arc minute of Cap, and that is square the Aries point. So that gets an Aries point effect of personal, political intersection, individual, collective intersection. I must have played that David Byrne song, Talking Head song, one of my very favorites, Television Man, with the line, "When the world crashes into my living room, television made me what I am." He's talking about the intersection of the individual and the collective through television in this case, which still is not only powerful, but the lingering effects of television in our culture are still, even though television is kind of obsolete in a way, it's merged with the cable system and the cathode ray tube is gone and all this, right? The cathode ray tube looks ridiculous now, right? Doesn't it? With all the flat screens out there. I mean, the cathode ray tube looks like cavemen would be watching it during, you know, during like the Pleistocene era or something. All right. So Saturn, right, square the Aries point, right in the first degree, with the sun conjunct Tholus conjunct the galactic center in Sag. So it's a Sagittarian event about Capricorn. Then, as if there was not enough Capricorn in this chart, the moon is in a conjunction to Pluto. The last thing that happens before Saturn enters Capricorn is the moon makes a conjunction to Pluto. It's about 2 hours before. So it's like one last bell rung by the universe as if to say, hey, here's what this might be about. Moon conjunct Pluto in Capricorn, pointing to Pluto in Capricorn. Another personal, transpersonal alignment. The moon being deeply personal, but also representing the public. Pluto being widely, massively public, affecting millions of people, but also with profound inner individual transformational effects. And that which is being transformed is government. We're going to see changes in government. The old order, granted a kind of a temporary order, but the old order of Saturn and Sag and Jupiter in Libra is over. That has completely been rearranged by Jupiter changing signs. And it will be rearranged yet again by Saturn changing signs. So over the next 3 months, we're going to see, I think, some stuck things start to move. A lot going on in the background that is element by element going to come to the forefront. So we will have some interesting experiences, but prepare yourself for movement. Just loosen up your energy a little bit and get ready to grow and change. For most individuals, Capricorn tends to exist on the level of family. Most people have limited involvement with the government. Admittedly, as the government gets bigger and bigger, more people are having more involvement with the government, but most people have limited involvement with the government, doing things like filing taxes and voting and jury duty and parking tickets. And so the miniature authoritarian state, the internalized family that Wilhelm Reich so eloquently speaks about, is the place where we're going to experience a lot of this. And one of the reasons why we have so much trouble with the government is because we haven't processed our family. And one of the reasons why these massive scale events like these mass shootings or 9/11 are so troubling is internalized family conflict. So speaking of this mass shooting thing, I want to just give you a super brief summary of the trajectory of my reporting on this with a reporting team and help from my Facebook friends. We kind of work as a team. Cindy Teistragusa and I are working as a research team, and she's almost like someone who can reach into a hat and like pull out whatever document you need. There are times when I just laugh. It's so funny that these documents come flying by. It's like, how did you find Stephen Paddock's fishing license? His fishing license? Well, so why are we even looking? So a couple happened. When I did this program last week, I was at the point where I was still largely accepting the primary narrative of the incident in Vegas on Sunday, October 1st, 10 whole days ago, hard to believe, at 10:05 p.m. I was still using that as my baseline narrative, doing whatever I could to whittle away at that, to look for alternative theories, things that contradict it. And at a certain point on Monday, I put up on my Facebook timeline, I said, is there any element of this story that contradicts the official narrative and or doesn't seem to add up, or that line of thinking? And once I opened up that discussion, it was like an invocation and stuff just came flying in. And so as of today, 1 week later, remembering this is my, I won't say it's so much my opinion as it is my finding as a reporter, that if I am faithful to my craft and my commitment to telling the truth as I see it and feel it and know it and have documented it, it does not seem to me that the sole shooter from the 32nd floor narrative is even vaguely true. I have never seen one of these mass shootings. We've analyzed almost all of them, the big ones that have come across the wire, where I thought, this is absolutely not holding up. Nothing about it anymore. There were shots fired. People died. People got hurt. Something happened in the city of Las Vegas around 10 o'clock on the 1st of October. But that's all the two scenarios have in common. Now, if we recall this, and by the way, I don't have a cohesive theory on the second scenario. What I have done is my basic investigative reporting technique, which is to take the official story and to first look to support or disprove it, to prove it or disprove it. Look for evidence that what we're being told is true, and look for evidence what we're being told is not true. I don't actually care that much that I have some attachment, some emotional attachment. If I have one, I would rather it be true because it's more convenient and easier and in a way much, much easier to understand. What is not easy to understand is why there were so many reports of shootings in Vegas that night that did not make national news, national television, cable news, not anywhere beyond local reporting, which is to say that Democracy Now!, which is pretty radically on the left, and Fox News, which is pretty radically on the Meshuggah bullshit right, all accept the same framework of events. One shooter, 32nd floor, pointed gun or guns at a concert across the street. That's the story. That is the official mainstream story. But notice when it's accepted, when that version of events, I have not heard them question this at Democracy Now! or not even question it. And it's the same story accepted by Fox, the same story accepted by MSNBC, and the same story accepted by CNN. And there's all these questions. I'm not saying that there really was a second shooter with a machine gun inside the venue. I'm not, but I have seen anecdotal evidence of that. I'm not saying for sure there was a second shooter on the third or fourth floor, but I've seen anecdotal evidence of that in the form of video footage. I'm not saying that those kids in the staff parking lot were chased and had to hide in a dumpster because the gunshot's getting closer, but the New Yorker published that story. I'm not saying for sure there were incidents on three floors of the Mandalay Hotel or shootings at the MGM. But those reports are out there. They are out there sufficiently that even if not accepted as true, it is strange that the main line of events is not being questioned in the light of these stories and that they're apparently not being followed up on by anyone except vloggers and bloggers and podcasters and kind of citizen journalists compiling hundreds of links on Facebook. And though the internet is contributing to plenty of madness and insanity, it's, to me, reassuring that people are courageous enough to start to do a pretty good job assembling this stuff. So Cindy and I spent a lot of time this week sifting through and weeding through this. And what I just ran through for you is a summation of some of the things that seem plausible. Then there's the why is the woman interviewed wearing the VIP pass, looks like a woman about 24 years old, standing there with a male partner about the same age. Why does it appear she appeared on Dr. Phil as like a crazy narcissistic guest? So the crisis actor phenomenon is something I am aware of and I am not dismissive of. It would seem that the same people appear as commenters from crisis to crisis. Not entirely so, but there's enough evidence of this to at least be a story lead, to lead journalists to question this. That's how journalism works when it's honest and when it's healthy. You get a lead. Someone says, hey, do you know so-and-so is happening? You don't go on the news and say that's happening. You take the time and you put some resources into it and you dig in and you find out what's going on. Like the priest at SUNY New Paltz, Father Damien, I was sitting in the cafeteria one day and he said, do you know that there's test wells being dug all over that was a contaminated campus? I was reporting on it. I said, no, I had no idea that there were test wells being dug to check for underground contamination. And he said, please don't tell anyone that I told you. And I said, I don't have to. I'm now going to take full ownership of this and investigate it and look and see if it's true. And sure enough, it was easily verified. Only because I looked, got it on page one of the local paper. That's what needs to happen with these leads. But what's so interesting is that the major media, who I will define as the ones who don't want to be seen to be crazy for being conspiracy theorists, stick to the same basic story. This does everyone a disservice. We need something with the power of Democracy Now to start chasing down all of these leads about additional shootings and second and third and fourth gunmen and people on the ground and kids being herded inside the arena by people with weapons that is being talked about. I'm not saying that that's true, but I'm saying there are witness reports that that is what happened, and those reports need to be followed up on by organizations that have the resources. I can tell you, based on my organization's research, that those reports exist, and I do not know enough to verify them or to dismiss them. I don't know, but I certainly am not going to dismiss them. I have it's completely irrational to do so. And things we don't like turn out to be true or true enough. And look, if any one of these things is true, even meekly, that completely blows away this neat, tidy theory of one guy with his guns in a hotel room who bashed out the window and just started shooting people for no reason. Now, all of that said, the big boys contradicted their own story this week. This was yesterday. There was a news briefing with the Las Vegas police. They had these kind of ridiculous daily news briefings. Have you seen these? With the one guy who looks like, he almost looks like a mafia hitman in a sheriff's uniform. And he kind of talks like one. And he has that kind of dopey face. Almost like either a good director trying to imitate a bad director in a movie or just bad directing. But he's got that kind of, look on his face. Oh, what? You're doing us all a disservice by having all these rumors out on the internet. You people, stop the rumors on the internet, all right? It's messing with our bullshit story. If you have, if you repeat that thing on television where the newscaster actually said there was shootings on three floors at a Mandalay Bay, shut up about that, all right? That's just, it didn't happen. Look somewhere else. True. Newscast. Local newscast. Anyway, one of these other Gavones gets up at the sheriff press conference yesterday and says, oh, by the way, the security guard, Jesus somebody, that was shot on the 32nd floor, he was shot before the whole mass shooting happened. The original version was he was shot after the whole thing happened, which doesn't really make that much sense. And I remember in one of the early briefings, one of the big chief sheriffs said, we engage the gunman. Thinking, wait a second. Engage means had a shootout with. This doesn't mean giving him a ring and then going down the block to Elvis and getting married. Engage means on the hotel floor. Hopefully not ever one of your or my hotel floors, but they engaged him before the whole thing happened. Now, that is a big alteration to the story on day nine. Day nine, they say, oh, by the way, I forgot to tell you, there was a shootout right before the big shootout. Okay, good. Next question. So this is, you know, I have the true flag theory, right? The true flag theory is all of this false flag stuff, like other gunmen, however plausible it may be or ridiculous it may be, doesn't matter. Because the quote-unquote real story is more than bad enough. But more than adequate. And it may be really, really horrendous. consider the possibility that there were several shooters on the ground. Kids hiding in a dumpster outside the staff parking lot? Because the gunshots were getting closer and closer, they felt like they were getting stalked, and they all jumped into a disgusting dumpster and hid together. That was in the New Yorker. What if that was true? I'm not saying it was true. What if it was true? Maybe. Hypothetically. Postulating. What is that? So, in looking at this scenario over and over again, I've attempted to come up with sketchy theories of what might happen. And I'm listening to other smart people's sketchy theories of what might have happened. And it almost sounds like one thing was supposed to happen and a whole other thing happened. A Benghazi-style cover-up. Right? Forget what the Republicans say about Benghazi. Something weird went down that night. And the thing that they said that thing was, where the ambassador and his security guards were killed, wasn't the thing that they say that it was. That building, that compound, that structure had a different purpose. And this thing went on, and the ambassador was there for some reason, and his security guards, all they got shot. And then piled on top of that, on top, was one more lame cover story after the next. In the end, creating a space of total confusion about what might have actually happened. Capitalized on by people who wanted to just make hay and make scandals for the sake of scandals. That's my impression of Benghazi, based on research that I did at the time. So this seems to me the closest to that. One thing was supposed to happen. That whatever was going on had one purpose. And then something went pear-shaped, as they say in England. And a whole other thing happened. Now, another scenario is that it was just a massacre. It was just a death squad massacre. And based on one assemblage of the known potential facts, that makes some sense. None of the scenarios are happy. The one I think is the most least true is that one dude who told no one he was going to do this and had no collaborators, no co-conspirators, it was just him, all by his little lonesome self, took 23 guns up to the 32nd floor, went gambling the night before, did whatever he did on Sunday, bashed out the window, and shot a bunch of people. That's the one I think makes the least sense and holds the least water. Now, before we go to break, listen to some more groovy Grateful Dead music. Consider this possibility. Imagine that something other than what they say happened, happened. By they, I mean everyone is saying basically the same damn thing. One dude, 32nd floor, 23 guns, bashed open the window, shot a bunch of people, blew his brains out, and that's it. Except for the part about the shootout right before, which kind of changes things just a little. And imagine that's not what happened. Imagine all kinds of stuff happened. Other stuff happened. There were these shootings up and down the strip, shootouts in various hotels, or there were people herded on the ground, or there was some effort by certain black ops organizations to kind of keep the whole thing hush-hush. And then imagine you're the chump from the sheriff's department who's put in front of the reporters who has to kind of stand there like you're holding in a shit, like you have to really, really take a shit. and you've got your sphincter closed around it, and you're hoping that your body just doesn't spew out this glorious hunk of shit. And you're standing there doing a little foot dance, and all these reporters are asking you questions. And you got this weird look on your face. Because you can't really say what's going on. You know part of or most of what's going on. You know something bigger than you is going on. But it's not what you're telling people. All right. Grateful Dead, part two. This is one of the songs that was played on the Playboy After Dark show from an album that had just come out, Oxymoxa. Kind of a palindrome, you know, those are, it just reads both ways the same way. And this is one of my favorite from the Celtic genre of Grateful Dead songs. So we first heard a country piece, Dark Hollow, and this is from another universe, and it's called Mountains of the Moon, and it's Jerry singing.
Mountains of the moon, electrobell, and bend to me. I hold the carrion crow, folly, rolly, riddle. I hold the carrion crow, bell, and bend to me. Hey, Tom Banjo.
Na 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 na.
Sons of the Moon. So what a beautiful thing with that kind of eerie sitting around the fire at summer camp on the last night kind of feeling, only even deeper than that. You can imagine it at like a Samhain celebration or something like this. But here are the lyrics, which were in somewhat unusual fashion amended by the lyricist Robert Hunter later on, who he felt one of the stanzas was not beautiful enough for the song, did not reflect his true intention, and he rewrote it. They put it into Jerry's teleprompter, and then he never performed the song again. So here it's a bit of an epic poem, but let's read some or all of it just to give a feeling. Cold mountain water, the jade merchant's daughter, mountains of the moon, bow and bend to me. Hi-ho, the carrion crow, folderol-de-riddle, kind of a folk nursery rhyme, folderol-de-riddle. Hi-ho, the carrion crow, bow and bend to me. Hey, Tom Banjo, hey, a laurel, more than laurel you may sow, more than laurel you may sow. Hey, the laurel, hey, the city in the rain. Hey, 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 the white wheat waving in the wind. 20 degrees of solitude, 20 degrees in all. All the dancing kings and wives assembled in the hall. Lost is a long and lonely time, fairy Sybil flying. All along, the mountains of the moon. This is a rewrite of that stanza. Here is feast of solitude. A fiddler, grim and tall, plays to dancing kings and wives assembled in the hall. Of lost, long, lonely times, fairy Sybil flying. All along, the mountains of the moon. Hey, Tom Banjo, it's time to matter. The earth will see you through this time. The earth will see you on through this time. Down by the water, the marsh king's daughter, did you know? Clothed in tatters, always will be, Tom, where did you go? Mountains of the moon, Electra, mountains of the moon, all along the mountains of the moon. Hi-ho, the carrion crow, folderol-de-riddle. Hi-ho, the carrion crow, bow and bend to me. Whew. The words of a man named Robert Hunter, still among us, still performs. So far as I know, I met him once, I shook his hand once, I did get to thank Robert Hunter for all of this beautiful stuff. Who wrote Mountains of the Moon and St. Stephen and Eyes of the World, those two songs coming up. Throwing Stones, which is at the end of it. I'm going out with a medley, because I put a lot of songs on at the end and not have to, you know, fill them in between with, not that I have any trouble doing that, but, you know. Throwing Stones, written by the Grateful Dead's other lyricists. See, this is one thing that makes them who they are, is the spectacularly painstaking care put into the lyrics. And the songwriters know the lyrics are not the ultimate meaning of the song, but if they are beautiful and they are deep and they are delivered by the singer, the lyricist disappears and the singer, in that case Jerry, delivers the message. And there's a whole bunch of us Deadheads who like to study and learn the lyrics. Grateful Dead are a literary genre, not just a kind of a collection of musical genres. Hi-ho, the carrion crow, bow and bend to me. Oh, this is interesting. Dead Bass gives only 10 performance dates for this song in the band's live repertoire between February and July of 1969. Set lists for this period are far from complete, however, so it's likely there were more performances. But Dead Bass, a bunch of deadheads who compile all the set lists, only have it listed 10 times. All right, so now on to part two of this weirdness in Las Vegas. So over the weekend, this person, Stephen Paddock's birth certificate surfaces. And that was just strange because it's so hard to get a birth certificate for anyone these days. And there's so little AA data, birth certificate in hand, that right away, I didn't question it right away. I just sort of like thought, well, what is this? And the copy that I was sent was like microscopic and you couldn't really read the birth date. So when you blow it up, it turns out that there's a controversy over the birth date. And apparently I'm on one side of the controversy and the entire rest of the world is on the other side of the controversy, by which I mean almost all astrologers and federal databases, state databases, various local databases, all have Paddock listed as being born on the ninth day of February, of April 1953, 4953. Me and my little motley crew here at Planet Waves, which include Cindy, the researcher I'm working with, and 4 out of the 5 handwriting experts I went to with the version I think is the most legible, and other people who are wise, people like Eric McLuhan, Marshall McLuhan's son, looked at the numbers and said, nope, look, that looks like a 4. Looks like a 4. Think that it's April 4th. And what is so strange is that even though, and by the way, I don't feel bad about this. I mean, I'm not thinking like, oh, all these people like the KISS Astrology Group, which threw me out of the group for asking, for raising this question and attempting to fact check this and really to look at the writing and to see that it really is the 4 in April 4 is a completely different glyph than the 9 in 1959. And there's no rational way to read them as the same numeral. You mean you can, but it doesn't make any sense. So I don't feel that bad that it seems like everybody is against us, except for I ran this handwriting past the following people. A forensic accountant. My accountant is an old-timey guy who likes old stuff. I know a lot of people who like old stuff. We're like kind of a little bit 19th century. So he's clearly a 4. Michael Fink, somebody I've worked with for 20 years on deed research, April 4th. A friend I won't name, retired FBI investigator and current investigator, April 4th. My mom. Hi, Mom. I wrote to my mom, who's a graphologist who studies handwriting analysis, where they really know how to read handwriting. Of all the esoteric arts, I think graphology is the one I would love to learn the most, even though there's very little handwriting going on, but that makes it even more influential. And Mom wrote back and said, you are right, April 4. The one person who did not say solidly April 4 was a man named Chris McGregor, who I don't mention very much. But in my life, there's sort of the office of the best friend. I have some good friends I love, but there's one person I consider my best friend, and this must be some ancient karmic thing, and I hardly ever see him anymore, and we've done lots of things together involving government and activism. His name is Christopher McGregor, and he's a title searcher. And he looked at it, And I said, you know, I said, Chris, what is this date? I looked up his, I hardly ever talked, looked up his cell phone and found his email. I ended up talking to his mother. Okay, so let's see. Let's see here. Sorry to take a minute to do this. See, his email doesn't... Okay, let's see. Good. Here, I found the thread. All right, so Chris is someone who I trust to challenge me on terms I understand and can follow the logic of. I mean, because we had this discussion going, you know, all over Facebook, and everybody was chirping, and I think it's a man, I think it's a man. And pretty much everyone thought it was a 9, even though I blew them both up and to the size of a house, and they are different integers. So, but the people who do this, who must read numbers and get them right, 4 of the 5 were certain it was a 4. So I finally thought, I should send this to Chris. So I sent it to Chris. I talked to his mom. I sent him a text message. I leave a phone message. And I said, Christopher, I'm asking you this because I am certain. What is the date that you see here? How close of a call is it your friend Eric F. Coppolino? Chris writes back to me. And he says, the appellate division, 3rd department, has determined it's a 9. Now, this is a deep inside joke involving a case we worked on for years, involving a court, the appellate division, 3rd department, falsely determining that a 4 was a 9. So this is Chris being funny. And what he's saying in this, the appellate division, 3rd department, has determined it's a 9 is... people who are complete blatant fucking liars and totally corrupt determined that that thing that looks like a 4 is a 9. So I wrote back and I said, I love you. As for the People's Court of McGregor of Bethel, what is your confidence level? And he replied. So I'm like, he succeeded in being quite funny. And then I had to focus him and be like, all right, come on, man. Come on, man. Cough up a little info. And he said... and I have to key you into a concept antecedent to this. In studying real estate, in particular surveying, to determine whether that piece of ground matches that description, there's something called the order of calls. That is the order of priority in which you assemble your logic, because surveying is engineering, and... you really want to make sure you get this right, of course, unless you're trying to get it wrong, which we've seen a lot of. And in the order of calls, the stated acreage of the land is the least important thing in determining whether that is the land being described. Following me here? You would think it was the most important thing. It's actually the lowest on the order of calls. Call 1. Meets and bounds, call 2, whatever, GPS location, whatever. The lowest on the order of calls is the acreage. And I mean, and the reason for that is, and Chris is going to explain it in a second, but let's say I buy a house at like one Main Street, and the square footage of the house is described, somebody sticks in an extra couple of zeros and I have a 1,000,000 square foot house. Clearly, that does not mean that I own the entire neighborhood. Just because my deed says it's a 1,000,000 square foot house, oh, I'm going to kick all my neighbors out and I'm going to have a nice pasture. So Chris replies, one reason why the quantity of acreage carries little weight in title matters is because the written number is subject to Scrivener's errors, sloppy handwriting, interpretation, etc., and can morph over time when copied over and over. A detailed property description is more like a fingerprint where only a fraction of the whole can still identify it as the whole. In this case, it looks like a 9 or a 4 with a circular loop going up where we'd rather see something with a 90-degree L straight line. I'm not sure which he's describing there. You would need additional samples of writing showing 9s and 4s to be more certain, or access Government Department of Health consecutive records. Greetings from Waco, Texas, where Hurricane Harvey only brought us welcome relief from the hot Texas sun. All right, so what Chris is saying is, basically, from his standpoint, he's calling it ambiguous, fourth or the ninth. My four other experts I consulted, including my mom, all said clearly the fourth. Now, I'm a symbolist. I'm an investigative reporter. I feel like I did my diligence. I worked with my team, and we ended up with like six separate copies of this birth certificate. I called the state of Iowa. I got my own shitty copy for $5 from the state of Iowa. People are going in, making better and better copies. By the way, the controversy of over whether Iowa's records are open and why I started to think it was kind of weird that there was a birth certificate floating around is that, to my knowledge, and I've done one other case in Iowa, the murders of the Moors and the Stillingers in Villisca in June of 1912. You might be familiar with this case. I have behind the scenes. I haven't written a peep about it on Planet Waves. Put tons of energy into investigating this 1912 murder. Spent some time with Iowa authorities and in Iowa looking up this thing. And at that time, about 7-8 years ago, you could not get birth records unless you were an entitled person, the son, the father, the grandson, the sister, something like this, to get a copy of the record for some legal purpose with extensive documentation of your entitlement and your identity. And suddenly there's these birth certificates apparently in two pedigrees circulating, the ninth and the fourth. And so I made a few statements that, well, to my knowledge, can't get a copy of the record in Iowa, so where the heck did this thing come from? Well, turns out, I call up Iowa, Clinton County, and very nice lady answers the phone, and quite patient, and good sense of humor, and explained, well, guess what? The law changed. On July 1st, 90 days to the day before this killing, not saying this is the Illuminati, but just 3 months ahead of it, the law changed, and now anyone can get a copy, non-certified copy, of the birth record, or come in and take a picture. That was not allowed before 7/1/17. So, they send me this ridiculously shitty copy, and probably worth $5, and just to say that I did it, right? And then other copies printed off of microfilm, black background, whitish, grayish text start coming out, and those look more like the ninth, and the pedigree that we have with the white page and black writing really looks like the fourth. That fourth really looks like an L stroke, two pen strokes. The nine looks like hook, right? Curve, hook, one pen stroke. That's really, in my thinking, the difference. But anyway, the FAA, where we looked up his pilot's license, has him as 4-9. DMV has him as 4-9, because the cops use DMV when they say the birthday. Fishing license, 4-9. Passport, circulated, date redacted. That's really interesting. Some TV station got it. I don't know how they got it. ABC got a copy of the front page, the one you're supposed to keep a copy of. Do you know this? If you have a passport, make a photocopy of the page with the picture and your signature of your passport. Make several copies. Leave one at home and take one with you and keep it separate from your passport. So if you ever lose your passport abroad, if you present that page, it radically facilitates the passport replacement process. Remember this. Do it right now or tonight or tomorrow. Get your passport out, make several color photocopies, and keep them in separate places. Anyway, that page gets sent out on the fucking internet with the birth date redacted. So it's me against the whole world. Me, except for my crew of experts who like, oh, you're not blind, you're seeing this. So I feel like, you know, I'm not, obviously, I think this is pretty funny. But here's the thing. The date of birth is like, who really cares? April 4th, April 9th, it doesn't change his age. Who cares except astrologers? Because the difference between the 4th and the 9th is a real difference. Two completely different charts. Because 4 days or 5 days have gone by, and that spins the wheel on a lot of variables. So there's two data sets going around. There's essentially two astrological identities. But it seems to me like everybody in the astrology scene, with the exception of Planet Waves, has completely accepted the official date of birth and the apparent nine in the April, apparently nine, version of things. I mean, I had one of the funniest Facebook messages that I've ever had. Gotta find this. Okay. That was just so entertaining. I hope I can put my hands on it easily. From someone who was basically pleading with me. Okay, here it is, here it is, here it is, here it is, here it is. All right. Mm-mm-mm. More replies, more replies, more replies. So, oh man, there's so many freaking comments. Glenn Perry, Glenn Perry, Glenn Perry, Glenn Perry. Alan Anand. That's not his name, by the way. Nobody's named Anand, but that's what he calls himself. All right, so he obviously followed my work at some point. And I'll probably skip over some of this. Eric Radzel Kaplinger, kudos to you for your diligence in ferreting out original birth records and this and many other cases. No one disputes your value to the astrological community in this regard. Drumroll, please. But, like Glenn Perry, I have doubts about how you're choosing to see field 6 in the birth record. As I commented in the top of the thread, I'm no handwriting expert, blah, 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 blah. You can't have it both ways, cherry-picking which digit to dispute. This is completely illogical because he's saying it could be 14. This guy could be born in 1453. That's ridiculous, right? And he kind of knows it, but he's saying, hence, you're wrong. And here's where he gets personal. Where in my mind it gets really giggly. On the other hand, in this thread alone, you're pushing a conspiracy theory. The strictly closed-door version of the story, we're dealing with a potential black op. The truth usually turns out to be way more complex than the cover story. He's quoting me. Seemingly unaware that I've spent 30 years of my life digging out these stories, not being any kind of a conspiracy theorist, but just like finding out how the contamination got in the building. Maybe you're right. Sometimes there is another narrative, but maybe here you're wrong. And this was no black op. By the way, I never said it was. Maybe it was just a man with a psychological disorder who suddenly snapped, as has happened so many times in America and elsewhere. Here's the part of the narrative that intrigues me. Quote, and in the end, we're left with two identities. And also, I mentioned, this is a metaphor for my life, which he doesn't understand, means I'm not afraid to completely dismiss the popular opinion and stand with the work that I've done, eagerly waiting to be proven wrong. He doesn't prove anything here. Astrological researcher versus conspiracy theorist. I don't think these two sit well together. Maybe you just need to step back and ask yourself, is your belief system interfering with your judgment? Like, well, yeah. My belief system is keep digging, prove a theory, then disprove it, keep digging. How many people can I possibly ask? I'm thinking, who the smartest people I know? So I thought this morning or last night, Eric McLuhan, he likes this stuff. He likes symbols. So it's not like I'm just looking at this saying, well, I think it's the fourth. Fuck you. I'm reading the chart. But here's the thing that's so hilarious about this from the astrological standpoint, which is that we have two sets of data. People may not like it. Somebody may say you're a conspiracy theorist for contemplating that the official narrative is not true and the official birth date is not true. You can say that. Okay, good. He said it. That's great. However, as symbolists, as people who work in metaphor. Ah, we have two sets of data. That's interesting all by itself. That stands on its own as a fact of the environment. You can argue which one is true or not, and call all the witnesses and pick which one you like, but you can't say that there's not two possibilities. Heck, we could also look up April 9th, 1453, and see what happened there while Columbus was sailing around, even though none of these people were alive except in previous incarnations. There are two sets of data. And it's not exactly as... I find it annoying, mildly, but that may be, you know, veiling murderous rage, that the astrology community just is like, ah, it's the ninth. You're wrong. We're kicking you out. But what is more puzzling to the little child in me is the failure to notice that there are two sets of data, and that is a metaphor, that is a symbol, that is really interesting. And when you add to that the question of who the heck was this guy without a motive? Who was this person that they just give us one day? He just appears, and suddenly he's the next Elvis. Yesterday he was nobody. He had a fishing license and he played video poker. And today he's a household word. So there's two data sets. And the data sets give charts. And this is interesting. Interesting. So with the materials for this program, connected to the letter, connected to the web pages on members.planetwaves or planetwaves.fm, and wherever we stick this, mail it out or send it or somehow spam it around, I will include a link to these chart sets. The chart sets are not labeled intentionally because this is all this fuss and bluster, but the top set is April 4th, the bottom set is April 9th, and on the left are the natal, and on the right are the progressions. I'll write a paragraph explaining that. And these charts give different people. Different people. First of all, the moon has changed signs. So the April 4th guy has a Sagittarius moon. The April 9th guy has an Aquarius moon, and because the time is not in dispute, 11:05 a.m., we know the house of the moon in both cases. So, for example, the April 4th guy, which is the pedigree of the birth certificate that I think is at least there, it exists, has a guy with a Sag moon. He's Cancer rising, but for example, Sag moon, 5th, 6th, meaning potentially he gambles for a living, which is what he made his living at. He made his money other ways, allegedly, but then he apparently was really good at making money at video poker. All right, that fits that. For another example, both charts have a powerful 10th house. 10th house meaning government connection. However, the April 4th version of Steve Paddock has Pisces on the 10th house cusp, government cusp, and then a bunch of stuff in Aries and Taurus, which would appear to put him at arm's length to the government. So here we have the kind of, it would seem like the version of Stephen Paddock where he is this innocuous guy who they're telling us he was, who liked to gamble, and who had no previous connections to anything, right? This is the story. Like, he's just, I mean, it's like in The Godfather where they're like, you gotta have somebody do the job with a clean record, right? So they can't be traced in any way. Still done. So he's the guy with, like, the clean record, who sends his mother cookies and all this stuff, and who's got Pisces on the midheaven. Like, this does not, unless you're me, denote a relationship with the government where, you know, you're really particularly interested in the government. It's just kind of laid back, and you pay your parking tickets, and you pay your taxes, and all that's good. April 9th, Steve Paddock, has Aries on the midheaven, and Eris nuzzled right up against the midheaven. That looks like government blood lust. Eris, in its worst manifestation, is blood lust. Combined with the Sun in Aries, retrograde Venus in Aries, now all solidly in the 10th, up against the midheaven, without the ambiguity created by Pisces, and the kicker, Cancer rising still, but the moon's in Aquarius in this chart, in the 8th house. This, the moon Aquarius is groups, 8th house is death, transformation. A lot of people got transformed last Sunday. Death and transformation in the style of the group, moon Aquarius. To me, April 9th guy looks like a mercenary or a soldier of fortune. He doesn't look like the ordinary Joe Blow that the government story says this guy was. Now, what's interesting is the astrologers who are sticking to the April 9th chart, and I can't blame them because it is much more the chart of a mass killer. It just is. So if you're looking for, if you've already conducted a trial of Stephen Paddock, and you've convicted him in your mind, and you're not questioning that, and you think that to question the narrative is a conspiracy theory, you're going to love this chart, because this guy is Mr. Bloodlust. The problem is, that's not who they're saying he was all the rest of his life. He's not supposed to be any kind of a government employee. He's not supposed to be previously involved in any way. Heck, nobody even knows why he cares so much. This is the big mystery. Why did he do it? Why does he care so much? You think you'd have to really care to do something that bad. You'd have to have what's called a motive. And it would seem in the April 9th chart, the chart that all of my colleagues are gaga over and that they'll have tattooed on their back, this ain't no Joe Blow in the April 9th chart. This is someone special, like you might see in movies, some undercover guy or some perhaps boss of killing operations. That midheaven in Aries with Eris on the midheaven, the hunger for blood of that Eris coupled with the government, this would be someone you think would be like a really intense CIA operative, like somebody really good at his job. But listen up over there in Kiss Group. It don't jibe with Joe Blow sending cookies to his mother, going fishing, and made a little money in real estate, and likes to go video poker gambling in Vegas for fun, who then one day just bashed out the window and shot a bunch of people. That narrative, the official narrative, doesn't fit with that chart. The official narrative fits with the April 4th chart, if you ask me, because of his ambiguous relationship to government, for example. Now, I can't say I think he did anything. And you've never once heard me say that about an accused shooter. I've heard all of these scenarios over and over again. And I don't dismiss them out of hand, but it's, you know, it always seems like, okay, show me, you know, give me some reasoning. Show me something that tangibly tears apart the narrative. The 9/11 chart, which I don't think I've done any time lately anyway, a thorough reading of the chart on this program, is a chart that shows there's a problem with the story and that the government and the terrorists change places, which is exactly the story of the next 15 years after 9/11. But I, even though I doubted it, I accepted the 9/11 narrative for 6 months because I'm not the it smells, I don't believe it type. My method is, this is weird, I'm going to keep digging. But I need some facts. I'm not looking for some supposition that things don't make sense, some notion that things don't make sense. Give me something, like a wedge to jam into the log and split the log open, right? That came for me on 9/11 when I got hold of a website called aseel.org in France, and they did an analysis of the Pentagon. And that included a photo, a Department of Defense photo of the Pentagon taken after the fire had been put out and after the wall had collapsed, because the wall stood intact for 29 minutes. And I know someone who saw it. I know Steve Inskeep at NPR, and he got there within about 7 minutes, and I called him, and he talked to me, and he told me, yes, that wall was standing. And then it fell. He was one of the first people at the scene. So that part adds up. But what did not add up was when I looked at this DOD photo, official primary source government document from defense.mil, and they had it at high res, I've got it saved somewhere. I took that photo apart for a week. I put it in Photoshop. I looked at the whole thing. I chopped it up into little pieces. I blew up a thing that emphasized the interior of the outer ring, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I did this. I had planned a week off, get this, to write erotic writing. And I ended up spending the whole week analyzing a single photo from the Defense Department. And at the end of that week, I realized, based on looking at every facet of this photo, every square centimeter of this photo, this is not a building that was hit by an airplane. This is a building where it looks like something blew up inside the building and pushed the wreckage outward. Now, this should have been easy to see on 9/11, but if you fly an airplane into a building, the wreckage and debris are going to follow the airplane. There's going to be a dent in the building. In this case, they're claiming that a jetliner hit the building, but all the debris went the opposite way. Sir Isaac Newton would be laughing. So that's, for me, what it took to really dig in and say, to understand in my mind and in using reason, rationality, and logic and evidence that there was something wrong. That's what I need. So if I have a belief system, that's the belief system. Mr. Music, please. This is called Saint Stephen. I think my notes say, I've crossed out all my source notes because it's not from Dick's Pick 16 in 1969. And I don't think it's from the Capitol Theater to 1971, but I'm pretty sure it's from 1969. I don't have my notes from the original show I was going to do, but it is a song by Hunter and Garcia called Saint Stephen. And I'll tell you a bit about it when the song's over. For now, let's just listen.